Thank you. Thank you. Horizont siehst du selten Sterne funkeln. Hörst du die Bullen? Kannst du sie sehen? Kraschen grad ein Schwarzkopf mit nem Kilogramm Schnee. Die Kriminalitätsrate steigt, die Drogenpreise sinken. Die Polizei findet Kilos bei Kindern und Pasch oder Gras. Scheiß auf die Schule, nur der Knast macht es hart. Die Nacht wird zum Tag, hier gibt's keinen Sonnenschein. Der Horizont zeigt uns nur Wolken, die weinen. Nur Beton und Asphalt, matgraue Blocks. Hass und Gewalt in den Plattenbaublocks. Die Last auf den Schultern, zu Hause die weinende Mutter. Und die Bullen machen Druck, Chart. Dealen ist ein Muss, Mann. Ich seh Leute, die studiert haben, trotzdem mit dem Bus fahren. Lieber tot anstatt hungern. Auslach sterben jung, reiche Leben lang. Das ist der Werdegang. Und ich wollte mich bei Merkel bedanken. Kannst du mich hören, du Schlampe? Lieber tot anstatt hungern. Auslach sterben jung, reiche Leben lang. Das ist der Werdegang. Und ich wollte mich bei Merkel bedanken. Kannst du mich hören, du Schlampe? Ja. Drama pur, Kopf gefickt, depressiv. Leben wie Hyänen in diesem System. Jeden Tag dealen, Brötchen verdienen. Different days, same shit, ho. Déjà vu, S8B. Du bist erst 17. Lass die Finger weg vom Coke und Whisky. Kiff sweet, denkst im Rausch ist das Leben schön. Probleme lösen sich nicht in Rauch auf Realität. Dieses Leben macht schizophren und suizidgefährdet. Und dann noch die Politik von Merkel. Die Polizisten nerven, bös. Das Leben ist kein Märchen. Tschö, mehr von der Knete will hier jeder. Um Stress zu vergessen, rollt man Haze in das Paper. Kinder auf Drogen oder Entzug. Die Straße dein Lehrer, die Schule tabu. Lieber tot anstatt hungern. Auslach sterben jung, reiche Leben lang. Das ist der Werdegang. Und ich wollt mich bei Merkel bedanken. Kannst du mich hören, du Schlampe? Lieber tot anstatt hungern. Auslach sterben jung, reiche Leben lang. Das ist der Werdegang. Und ich wollt mich bei Merkel bedanken. Kannst du mich hören, du Schlampe?
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasianaut is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And our lovely followers and patrons who give us money every month to let us know how much they like the show, to invest in it. And it's really helpful, too. So we can, I actually solve my audio problems. So that's part of the the benefit of some of the patron money. Yeah, I went back to a different system and got rid of the other one. I don't know what happened to it. But at any rate, please consider becoming a patron if you're not. Go to patreon.com/youreanaut or to youreanaut.org and sign up, become a patron, and chip in a few bucks. Okay, so...
How are you, Sean?
Oh, how am I? I am doing... I'm doing good. I was in Princeton last week, as you know, and I went to this conference on... This is the second conference I've went to. The first one was at NYU in October. This one was organized... pretty much by the same people, but it was in Princeton, which is a beautiful campus, by the way. I'd never been there before. And the conferences are bringing together academics and people who do podcasting or audio and trying to get academics to think about audio as an additional form, but also a legitimate form of knowledge production.
That sounds actually that sounds like a fun conference. What are some of your impressions?
Well, first off, for me personally, it's incredibly inspiring because I don't have to, like, people, we're all on the same page. Like, we all see the potential that audio can do to bring academic ideas to a wider audience, to have that expression in a more creative and artistic form. And it's nice that I didn't have to, you know, you don't have to, like, try to convince reluctant academics to think about things in a different way. Everybody was on board there. And, you know, as I was telling you before we started, I think one of the things that people are thinking of is how do we, audio is not there to replace, say, the traditional academic study or monograph or article or whatever it may be. It's there to supplement. It's there to bring the knowledge to a different audience or to provide a creative outlet that reflects more academic work that maybe people who aren't specialists, you know, might not be interested in, right? So people are thinking in those directions. One of the issues that came up that I thought was really funny was academic concerns about peer review. And one of the participants who is a very well-known podcaster named Chenjerai Kumanyika, he's great. I highly recommend everybody listen to his series on the history of the NYPD called Empire City. He stood up and he said, you know, in the production meetings for Empire City, I got more feedback and had to do more corrections and more like revisions and more discussions than I've ever had at academic peer review. He's like, let's not fetishize it now. And I think he's right. And I think that's the other thing too. Like for me personally, what we do is such a solitary endeavor. And the audio component ideally puts you in a team situation. And I find that very exciting and quite inspiring. And it also, too, like it makes me think that what you and I do here really matters. And more people are starting to do it. So we're kind of ahead of the game in some respects. So the other thing, too, and this is something I've been harping on for many years, is that there is an audience out there for what we do. There are people who would be interested to hear this information and these stories. The problem is how to present it in a way that they can access it.
Yes, storytelling is a difficult trade.
It's a very difficult trade. So, like I told you before we started, I'm going to try looking into maybe holding something like the third iteration of this conference here at Pitt. Maybe in the fall. So,
that'd be exciting. Yeah.
You could come.
Yeah. We made so many plans.
Yeah. So, since you'll be in Michigan, you're closer. Yeah. Maybe you can, you know, if we do it in the fall or even in the winter.
I can't believe we're going to live 4 hours away from each other.
I know. Same time zone.
It's
crazy.
It's dangerous.
Yeah. So those are some of my thoughts. Of course, I could talk about this for a really long time. Unless you have any more questions, we can move on to.
Yes, let's move on to the interview, which is very fitting for this conversation because it's with Alena Ledeneva, whose most recent book also uses various kinds of art forms to go along with the book. specifically images, sculpture, and sound.
Yeah, the book has a soundtrack. It's an album called The System Made Me Do It, which I just love that.
Yeah, the title is just amazing.
You can find it on Spotify, but we'll do a link to all of that as well so you can listen to the music. And as you said, I want to point out the images of the sculpture that accompany each chapter were sculptures done by her. So here is a great example of a political scientist, academic, whatever, kind of branching
Here's
out.
Here's a great example of a Renaissance woman who's good at everything.
I mean, I think it's wonderful to really exercise our creativity in these new ways.
Absolutely.
You know,
if you have the means and freedom to do so, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and of course, everyone should know about her work. She's written 3 books on blot and informality in Russia.
All right, without further ado, let me introduce Alena Ledineva. Alena Ledineva is professor of politics and society at the University College London and a founder of the Global Informality Project. She is the author of the trilogy Russia's Economy of Favors, How Russia Really Works, and Can Russia Modernize? Her new book is The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns, published by UCL Press. Here's Alena Ledineva.
Well, Alena, it's very lovely to talk to you. I've been a longtime admirer of your books. I've also read all of them up to this point. Very influential. And you have a new one titled The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns. And I, of course, was struck by the very first line of the book in the preface, which reads, "The West is obsessed with Putin, but not really interested in Russia." So why did you begin this way? And what do you mean by that?
Why? It's because I live on the top of a bookshop. And every time I look at the shelf, which is about politics or Russia or something like that, all I see is Putin. And for me, it's quite frustrating because I come from Siberia and really do not consider myself ever being interested in Moscow or wanting to be there. So never been really a political person. So it is a little ironic that I'm professor of politics now. But I also have to say that this phrase doesn't belong to me. I actually cite my esteemed colleagues, Andrew Wilson and Mark Leonard and Ivan Krastev, who first made that observation about Russian studies, which are, of course, very diasporic in nature. And when people leave Russia, they develop the attitude to Russia on the basis of Western reporting, which also normally has Putin in the titles. So, and that kind of focus on Putin leaves a blind spot, in my view, which is where my work on informality comes in.
For me, the latter part of the statement is the interesting one, in the sense of we're not interested in Russia. So you clearly, like you said, with informality, are trying to paint a different picture of Russia that decenters Putin or calls us to actually put him to the side and look at other things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I certainly aim with this book, which arguably will be my last academic text, to go beyond Putin and think about long-term agenda for non-systemic opposition, forces which are being shaped as we think about the world once the Russia fully-fledged invasion into Ukraine stops, once we are through the regional wars that we experience at the moment in the Middle East and elsewhere. I really tried in this work to think in a longer term, starting with the patterns of modernization from the period of origins of the Russian state and looking in a very broad brush as to where the problem is, because it looks like we are stepping on the same rake, if you know that Russian expression. You make the same mistake about Russia, so much so that Russian experts came up with this paradox that the only predictable thing about Russia is its unpredictability. We also have Russia's insiders, such as Saltykov-Shchedrin, who said that every 5, 7, or 30 years, depending on the citation, everything changes significantly in Russia, but in 200 or 300, nothing changes. So that kind of paradoxical observation from the outside or by internal observers made me thinking, okay, not what's wrong with Russia, which is very often the pitch when we look at the Russian facades and the institutional structures in Russian politics, but rather think about what works and works so effectively that the institutions do not develop. And that has been my key question, not just in addressing Russia, but also as part of the Global Informality Project, where I look at the contexts with a bottom-up approach in order to sense as to how things get done and problems get solved in everyday life by people. So my approach is, let's think out of the box. You know, let's think how we could see Russia differently. Also, not making it so unique, because what I see in the Western analysis of Russia is that Russia is seen as a kind of this peculiar monster, huge, worth digging into, interesting, but truly unique. And this exceptionism, to me, is quite problematic. And now I could say this. You know, when I did How Russia Really Works, or Can Russia Modernize, or Russia's Economy of Favors, I actually didn't question that assumption. But ever since I started working on the Global Encyclopedia of Informality, and now the Global Informality Project covers 5 continents, over 100 countries, I understand much more about uniqueness and specificity. Also, in the way in which I could see unique structures all over the world, they are pretty universal human ways of behavior in conditions of shortage or pressure or stress. However, those universal practices, they become localized in a context-sensitive way. So those informality patterns, they are truly glocal.
Glocal. I haven't heard that. That's a great word.
Glocality of informality. That's a new buzz word, you know.
This discussion and the discussion me and Sean had yesterday made me wonder, do you feel like ultimately this idea that Russia is always becoming, that Russia is always kind of lagging behind but trying to catch up, is this ultimately a case of Orientalism on the part of Western scholars or politicians, etc.? Would you agree or not?
Well, I didn't think about it in those terms. You know, when I talk about West-centric views of Russia, I don't mean that the analysis that we have, they are exotic in any way or orientalist in their scope or perspective. I actually teach quite a lot of political science and I use the conceptual tools, and I think it's very important way to compare Russia to the rest of the countries from political science perspective. But what my perspective adds to it is that sort of bottom-up entry point on informal praxis. Maybe I better give an example. So, for example, I came across with the 6 paradoxes of socialism. And that was really interesting for me because it's an anecdote of the Soviet times. I actually remember it. It goes as six paradoxes of socialism. So there is no unemployment, but nobody works. Nobody works, but productivity increases. Productivity increases, but shops are empty. Shops are empty, but fridges are full. Fridges are full, but nobody satisfied. Nobody satisfied, but everyone votes in support of the system. So give me a better definition of socialism in the Soviet period. I have not come across one. But when you look at this closely, it's quite interesting. Well, every paradox hides an informal practice that actually solves it and, you know, makes it absolutely obvious that, yes, that's a facade.